Computing Culture, this week on Soundings. Hello, this is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Join me now for a conversation about computers and privacy. I'll talk with Tom Johnson, a professor of journalism at San Francisco State University. Before that, how computers are reshaping traditional conceptions of life itself. Science writer Stephen Levy of Macworld magazine will discuss his new book, Artificial Life. Major funding for this program comes from the National Endowment for the Humanities, with additional support from the A.J. Fletcher Foundation, Carolina Power and Light Company, the Neutrogena Corporation, and the Daniel and Joanna S. Rose Fund, Incorporated.
The creatures cruise silently, skimming the surface of their world with the elegance of ice skaters. They move at varying speeds, some with the variegated cadence of vacillation, others with what must surely be firm purpose. Their bodies, flecks of color that resemble paper airplanes or pointed confetti, betray their needs. Green ones are hungry. Blue ones seek mates. Red ones want to fight.
Stephen Levy reading from his new book, Artificial Life, recently published by Pantheon. According to Stephen Levy, the pursuit of artificial life is as old as science. But with today's sophisticated technology, computer scientists and biologists are creating digital replications of the behavior of organic life in ways that differ from life as we know it. It's now possible, in other words, for computer programs and robots to behave like living organisms, capable even of reproducing themselves. Stephen Levy is a scientific journalist and contributor to Macworld magazine.
Artificial life is the attempt to replicate actual behaviors of life itself in a different medium than life as we know it, most often the computer, but also in the behavior of robots or even pots of chemicals.
All right, now what goes into this? I mean, are we talking about organic interactions with computers, or are we talking about things that happen only inside of computers?
We're talking more of computers as organisms, or things that happen in computers as organisms, as opposed to, you know, treating the machinery itself like an organism. It's possible actually to create computer programs which behave like living organisms. Uh-huh. They can reproduce, they can look for food, they can even have sex.
All right, now the key word there, I take it, would be behave, two words, behave like. Are they alive, in fact, or do they simply resemble what we call life?
One thing I found while working on artificial life was that there is a lot of confusion, actually, as to what the definition of life itself is. And I think that's a problem.
Well, we could try that with the scientists and the philosophers, for example.
Well, exactly. And I think one of the hurdles of artificial life is, you know, to satisfy people who ask, how could this be living, something inside the computer? Mm-hmm. You're going to have to arrive at a definition of life. And when you think about it, what's important about life really isn't the materials that something's made of. The reason why we consider life special is because it behaves in a way that no other thing on Earth behaves.
Now, don't scientists have something better to do than to try to figure out, I mean, if we've got life itself, why do we have to have artificial life? What is the benefit here scientifically?
There's two benefits. First of all, by creating life, we're going to understand life a lot better. We're kind of hamstrung in the way that we view life because we only know one kind of life, that same kind that began back then in the primordial soup, mm-hmm. and followed a certain path to all the diversity of life we see today. But it could have taken other paths. There could be other kinds of life, even made of other materials. So trying to understand life with only our life is trying to understand ice cream, only tasting vanilla ice cream.
Right.
If we can make the strawberries and the chocolates and the rum raisins, we're going to learn a lot more about the concept of life and learn which parts of life that are peculiar to our weird kind of life, uh-huh. and which are universal to all kinds of life.
What about the ethics of science in this enterprise of artificial life, Stephen Levy? I mean, we have human beings who are designing programs and making them work with sophisticated hardware. Is there a sense of responsibility to oneself as a scientist, to the society, as this work continues?
Well, here we're treading on a little murky ground. Certainly, to date, the record of human beings in controlling nature has not been a great one. And when we're creating artificial life, what we're really talking about is drawing upon the forces of nature to make things which are in some ways and possibly in every way living. So it's possible that these things are going to go in a way that we can't control them. Interestingly, the scientists of artificial life, especially the ones at Los Alamos, consciously say, let's make this a different kind of project than the atom bomb. Let's make it an open project. Hmm. Let's have a lot of public oversight. On one hand, it's very encouraging. On the other hand, I'm not sure that it's going to make a difference, because they are so bent on following the path that's going to lead to autonomous living artificial creatures.
All right, now an open system that, as it were, takes the high road. Let me suggest a darker scenario. Should we worry about governments and conspiracies and trilateral commissions and clubs of Rome and people in small dark rooms who are doing things with computers? Ernst Blofeld, Spectre, James Bond, all of that.
I don't think that's the quarters that's going to provide the worries. I think we're more worried about some of these techniques being used either by teenagers releasing computer viruses, which are currently the most advanced form of artificial life, and also the well-meaning experiments of some of these artificial life scientists hoping to use them for the second point of artificial life, which I didn't get to, was to get them to do some of our bidding, to get robots smarter than they are otherwise to do tasks for us, to get new ways of fighting diseases, mm-hmm. to evolve molecules to fight diseases. That kind of technique could also come back against us when things get a little beyond our control and operate according to their own ends and not for the ends of their creators.
Well, whether we're going to take the high road or the low road, the dark side or the happy side of artificial life, tell me, Stephen Levy, about Genghis and about Attila. These are two robots that exist where, at MIT?
Right. The MIT Mobile Robot Lab, which is nicknamed the Artificial Insect Lab, operates on artificial life principles.
Uh-huh. Wasn't that a Tom Selleck movie?
It might be one day. It's interesting. As it turns out, you don't need to have a robot, which is a miniature human being, in order to have interesting things happen. You'll have better success if you look a little, a different place in the evolutionary scale in insects, because insects are very clever in terms of adapting to their environment and moving around. So let me tell you about Rodney Brooks's idea, he's the head of the MIT Robot Lab, for using his robots. He wants to colonize Mars with these guys.
Oh my goodness.
He wants to send 200 of these 2-foot-long, 6-legged insect robots up to Mars, and they're going to work together like an insect colony. And if one guy breaks down, the other fellows just push him out of the way or maybe scavenge him for parts, and that way we have a much more robust project. It wouldn't all go wrong if one guy went wrong.
All right. Well, regardless of whether we're talking about colonizing Mars or doing things here on Earth, who's running this project? Is it a bunch of lots of scientists in different parts of the world, or is there a central sort of organizing intelligence at work here?
Well, like life itself, which is kind of decentralized and a bottom-up process where a lot of things go on at once and get global behaviors, the science of artificial life is proceeding that way. There's no head, there's no brain dictating where it's going to go. There's a lot of scientists working in parallel, some for different reasons, all working in a sense with this emergent behavior of hoping to get life from non-life. So if there's no one to give an order saying stop, if that's what you mean.
What kinds of scientists are working on this project? My sense would be we got computer people, we got physicists, many categories of scientific inquiry.
You're right. It's really a multidisciplinary effort. Computer scientists work with biologists who work with physicists who see this as a way to understand the complexity not only of living things but of other things in the universe. And there's ethologists and entomologists and philosophers looking at it.
Yeah, well, let's pause on that for a moment. What about the again the ethical concerns? Do we have people who are looking at this and warning us not only about the benefits but warning us of the dangers here?
Absolutely. People look at the novel Frankenstein as opposed to the movie, actually, and they see that the villain in Frankenstein was not the Frankenstein monster,
but the doctor
sure. who had the hubris to feel that he could create life and control it. So, people are looking down the road and worrying about that. They worry about the creation of a technology which could conceivably lead to human beings becoming extinct. Some artificial life scientists I've spoken to actually believe they are setting a process in motion by which human beings will create their evolutionary successors.
Do the scientists who work on artificial life, Stephen Levy, go to a movie like Terminator and say, absolutely preposterous? Or, I mean, how imaginative are they?
They say, not impossible, but not worth doing. Because, you know, the Terminator is more like a human being. What they want to get are things that we couldn't even imagine getting. Nature is incredibly creative. You look around at our biosphere and you see an amazing diversity of, you know, animals and plants, which no human being could have even thought of or imagined. That's the same kind of diversity that we're going to get by drawing upon those same forces of nature to do the designing of our artificial creatures.
What is it that that excites you the most, and what is it that concerns you the most about artificial life?
Well, we've talked about some wild scenarios in the future. I think in the short term, what's very exciting is that by creating life, we're going to understand it better. And we're going to understand our place, really, in the universe by creating a different form of life. It's really going to expand our vision of what life is and where we stand in it. And it certainly expanded mine in writing the book.
So it's essentially a beneficial, benevolent kind of enterprise.
Well, I think within our lifetime it will be. And I think probably within my son's lifetime. But if my son has a child, I think that they may start worrying about the behavior of these artificial creatures.
And you go back and look at Grandpa's book and say, here was the beginning of it, or at least the chronicle.
I hope so.
Stephen Levy, I want to thank you for your contribution to Soundings. You are the author of Artificial Life. Your book is published by Pantheon. Thanks for coming by the National Humanities Center. Good luck in your work.
Thank you. I enjoyed it.
You're listening to Soundings, a weekly magazine of ideas and insights from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond.
Americans today are in a crucial period in a major revolution in the history of humanity. It's the second revolution in how humans create, store and exchange data, analyze it, and communicate the results to others. One of the significant dynamic effects of this revolution is the creation by outside forces of an electronic personality that shadows most Americans.
Tom Johnson, a professor of journalism at San Francisco State University. Johnson's at work on a project entitled The Digital Revolution, an investigation of computers, privacy, and journalism. In the age of digital computers, Johnson argues, each of us has an electronic personality, a kind of shadow computer profile that's available both to sellers and consumers of information. People with access to worldwide telecommunications networks. I asked Tom Johnson to reflect on the social implications of how those systems work and how they affect traditional notions of privacy.
The digital revolution is, in my view, actually the second major revolution in how humanity has stored and communicated information through the ages. The first era or epoch was when all information was maintained in the human brain and communicated by voice or what the eye could see. Then along about 3000 BCE, somebody invented writing, and suddenly information was able to be stored in something other than the brain, and it was able to be communicated both over space and time. We move into the late 19th century, 1890 or thereabouts, when a fellow by the name of Hollerith invented a card which became the computer data card.
Let me stop you for a moment. This is right. A remarkable revelation. We go back to 1890 for the beginnings of what we now call computer technology.
Well, in a primitive form, sure, because you had this cardboard card with holes or not holes, and that allowed a mechanical device to store information in some form other than print. Uh-huh. What that required, though, was a code book to be able to read this stuff and also the mechanical tools to be able to decipher it. So we move from that period up to what we have today, where things are no longer stored on cardboard cards, Hollerith cards, but rather they're stored in digital form in computers.
What do you mean by the digital epic? I mean, that word has a certain weight to it. Well, a Cecil B. DeMille quote. quality.
That's right. Well, I think we're moving into this third phase in humanity, the digital era, wherein information can be stored still in the brain and communicated orally or visually, or it can be stored in print and communicated to anyone who is literate in the traditional sense. But in this third era that we're entering, it is stored just as a matter of bits and bytes, just electrons. And what that requires is a special kind of literacy, a new kind of literacy to decipher whatever that stuff means.
It also requires a certain amount of attention to who gets into this information, who can use it, how it's distributed, and what we, that is to say, the human beings who are the source of the information, have to say about all of that.
Well, the questions, I think, are multiple. The leading ones are, number one, how many databases are there, and what's in them? And frankly, we don't know. Some people estimate that the federal government alone, just in Washington, has about 2,000 databases. One author says that 11% of those are secret. What kind of things are being held? Everything from, again, your birth records, your Social Security information. I just saw in the paper today that a system is now being set up that all Medicare will be paid for. We will each carry a card, or Medicare users will carry a credit card-like device, and that will be used to pay electronically for your insurance coverage.
Should we acquaint a word like secret with a word like sinister?
Not necessarily. One of the things that I'm interested in is trying to figure out what do we mean by the word privacy. There are some things that we do which are what I call public-private acts. For example, if we're walking down the street and we give $10 to a homeless person, we are in fact performing an act in public, but for a variety of reasons we might not want other people to see that, to observe that. To say that sinister and secret are the same, no, I think not. Not always, anyway. But one of the challenges of this area is that the multiple definitions and sometimes very limited definitions of the word privacy.
When we say, Tom Johnson, that we have lost our privacy, what are we talking about? Again, is this the sort of utterly individual difficulty or a social problem?
What? Well, that's the big question, Wayne. To say that someone has suffered an invasion of privacy or has suffered a loss of privacy, what in fact do we mean? And part of my search, a big part of my search, is to try to get a handle on that, because I don't know. Have we lost something physical? Obviously not. Have we lost face in the sense of some cultures? Well, maybe so. Have we lost part of our soul, like some cultures would believe that a photograph will do? We don't know.
One of the remarkable things that you point out in this paper that you've written on privacy is that of all of the, hundreds, thousands of academic journals, there is none with the word privacy in the title. That's amazing.
Exactly. This was a big surprise to me, because as I started thinking about these issues, I don't have any answers, but I do know how to use the library somewhat. And so I used my computer about 4 o'clock in the morning and got into a database that indexes the table of contents to 12,000 journals. And I said, well, there must be a Journal of Privacy Studies. After all, this is a wonderfully large tent that a lot of scholars can get under. Not one.
What about political privacy? That's a term that comes up here in the paper that you've written. It's also been the subject of a lot of controversy in our recent elections. Is there a definition? What do we mean by political privacy?
Well, I think that sometimes issues of current concern are pushed into the political arena. The current and perhaps classic example that we see today is the issue of abortion. In my view, the argument is not so much about abortion or about a woman's right to control her own body, but if we take it more deeply, it has to do with fundamental aspects of privacy and the dichotomy between the individual private self and our public acts. And Americans are the most determined individualistic people in the world.
We could also talk about financial privacy. You mentioned, for example, modesty, embarrassment, and sin.
Yeah, right.
moving from the utterly social to the intensely individual.
That's right. And all of these touch on aspects of privacy in some way. And we don't do a very good job either as journalists or as scholars in trying to, in separating these out and trying to determine whether or not one is The degree of importance of these areas to the function of society.
All right. Now, I mean, we could go on, you know, at great length about this, Tom Johnson, and I suppose these are questions that everybody has to struggle with, him or herself. What does your study of privacy have to do with journalism? Let's get to what you do as a professor.
Well, if one wants to carry the argument to extreme, all stories that a journalist does a touch on the privacy of some individual. I can do a story about the change in interest rates as imposed by the World Bank, and if we really want to get ridiculous about it, how does that affect an individual tribesman in Kenya? But journalists, in fact, increasingly are using these databases as a way to generate new knowledge, to make the invisible visible. For example, forgive me for taking a moment with this, one of the classic stories of computer-assisted journalism involves a reporter in Rhode Island 10 or 12 years ago who got a computerized tape of all of the people in Rhode Island who were licensed to drive school buses. Similarly, he got a tape of everyone who had been convicted of drunken driving.
Oh boy! Now we start correlating, huh?
Precisely. You go in and you do a sort, and you say, are there people on this tape of drunk drivers who also know are licensed to drive school buses?
So who got in Dutch here? The school bus drivers or the journalists?
Well, they ran the story. The journalists did very well with it. Did a lot of prize-winning pieces. But the issue is one of today in some states. The statutes are such that we could not get those drunk driving convictions. Now, I would argue that the body politic has a right and indeed a need to know how many drunken school bus drivers do we have, for example.
All right. Well, now we come, therefore, to a sort of key question in this study that you've conducted, Tom Johnson, about privacy in journalism. How do we figure out the dividing line so that we have the government having access, or corporations, companies having access to information that is indeed useful and necessary to the work of the world without invading the privacy of the individual?
You're exactly right, Wayne. That is the key question, and I don't have the answer. What I'm simply arguing is that it's time to get this issue out on the table so that it can be debated by the voters, by the citizens of this country.
How's that going to happen?
Well, I think, I hope that journalists, for one, will take the lead in this and start writing stories and exploring this dilemma that we have.
Well, now, wait. Now, in all due respect, Tom, the journalists, you know, they rank down there with the used car salespeople when it comes to our ethical evaluation of that segment of our society. Am I being too harsh?
No, not at all. You're being perfectly correct. I mean, you look at the tabloids every day. You see amazing things on television, which I would construe as an invasion of privacy, however sloppy that definition might be, that just amaze me. And so are we the ones to take the lead? Well, in this case, I will remain eternally optimistic and hopeful. I hope that my colleagues and I will start to advance the argument and get people thinking about exactly what information am I as an individual willing to give up, under what circumstances. I was quite surprised, for example, a couple of weeks ago, one of the national pollsters reported that nearly two-thirds of the people surveyed thought that it was appropriate for the government to have to make public individual information pertaining to their genetic map. I was surprised and puzzled by why people would be willing to give that up. This is the kind of information which will conceivably indicate your propensity to various kinds of diseases. There was an interesting attempt earlier this summer to hold a conference on whether there were genetic relationships between, or genetic relationships and crime, if there were any correlations there. So I was surprised at the public attitude for this kind of thing.
Well, one problem might be that people don't know the implication, the depth, the extent of the use of this knowledge.
I think so, and I think that's where journalists can really perform a substantial public service by not crying for action other than consideration. Because I'm afraid, what if we don't do this, and if this is not debated well by the public, by the citizenry, that there will be some catalyst that will trigger a draconian measures in Congress, which will simply drop the door, and we won't be able to find out about the drunken school bus drivers.
What kinds of people do we need to bring together to concatenate to properly here to get to these answers. We need government people. We need journalists. We need, I say this with a straight face, the philosophers, the people who define notions of the person and the individual. Who else?
Yes, the theologians, architects, the human ecologists, as I suggested. And also we need the people who are in business and doing very well selling our digital personalities.
Mm-hmm. Tom Johnson, I want to thank you for your contribution to Soundings. You are a professor of journalism at San Francisco State University. You're working on a project here called Privacy in the Digital Age. Thanks for coming by the National Humanities Center. Good luck in your work.
Thank you, Wayne. My pleasure.
You're listening to Soundings, a weekly magazine of ideas and insights from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. In a moment, I'll tell you where to write if you'd like a cassette copy of this week's show. You've been listening to conversations about computers and culture. My guests were Stephen Levy, a science journalist and contributor to Macworld magazine, and Tom Johnson, a professor of journalism at San Francisco State University. Stephen Levy's new book is Artificial Life, recently published by Pantheon. Tom Johnson is working on a study of computers, privacy, and journalism. Send $5 for a cassette tape of this show or $2 for a Soundings catalog. Write to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. The zip code is 27709. The program number this week is 638. That's number 638, the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. The zip code is 27709. The center welcomes your comments and suggestions. Next week, we'll end 1992 on a romantic note. Join me for a conversation with Kathy Davidson, a professor of English at Duke University. We'll talk about her new collection, The Book of Love. Major funding for this program came from the National Endowment for the Humanities, with additional support from the A.J. Fletcher Foundation, Carolina Power and Light Company, the Neutrogena Corporation, and the Daniel and Joanna S. Rose Fund, Incorporated. Thanks for listening to Soundings. Please join me again next week at this time on this radio station. Until then, this is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Computing Culture, this week on Soundings. I'm Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Join me for conversations with science writer Stephen Levy and Tom Johnson of San Francisco State University. Stephen Levy talks about his new book, Artificial Life, subtitled The Quest for a New Creation. Tom Johnson discusses computers and privacy. Computing Culture, some answers and insights from the National Humanities Center, this week on Soundings.